Nacos carefully locked the door behind himself. He hastened to tell his tenants in the adjoining house that their landlord had arrived and would be coming and going for the next 2 weeks. They welcomed him happily and said they'd join him at the taverna. On foot, he wound down cobblestone streets to Spiro's, there met with an uproar of cheers and press of handshakes and hugs, with the band blasting and banging its approval. Elena brought out dish after dish of treats from the kitchen, a celebrated cook whose hips carried ample proof of her life's great pleasure. Eligible ladies sitting with family and friends eyed Nikos, but he was too shy to return flirtatious glances. He drank, laughed, sang, and danced heartily with his brother and old chums. By midnight, he struggled up the back stairs to his brother's home above the taverna. Pleading exhaustion, he fell asleep on a sofa the second he lay down. Spiro removed his shoes, and Elena covered him with a blanket and snugged it under his chin. Breakfast the next morning was a long, lively affair. She presided over a generous table of eggs, meats, fruits, and fresh-baked buns. A parade of nieces and nephews popped in to greet their favorite great-uncle. Nikos came prepared. He slipped an American $20 bill into each big and small departing hand. Eyes lit up, and when he told them to put it in the bank, heads nodded. Stores would be exchanging them for candy and electronic gizmos by noon. Nikos told Elena in detail about his import-export business, especially the lambskin samples he brought in from Athens, which came from Thessaloniki. He would drive north soon to talk to suppliers there and visit friends, of course. For this day and next, however, he would sleep off his jet lag. It would be nice while he adjusted to home, if no one disturbed him at his apartment. Elena agreed to guard his privacy, to his relief. By mid-morning, Nikos walked back to his little suite, gritty-eyed but buoyant. As he stepped over cobbled streets, he flicked his worry beads, ovals of sunlit amber on a worn string, silently praying, please, with each one, that everything go as his ladies planned. He tiptoed in and sighed with relief. Alma was fine. Maya was hanging on. She had no interest in food and little in liquid, even of her precious tea. Nikos left them again to make his rounds of family and friends, happily embraced on the street and in their homes. The second night, Nikos ate a late supper at Spiro's taverna, then drove to visit an old classmate, the night guard at the Delphi Museum. They reminisced, sharing several beers in a room of frozen warriors, statues from history's endless march turned to phantoms by night. They laughed at the simplicity of such employment, since a sophisticated alarm system allowed his friend a good night's sleep, while several drinks guaranteed it. Nikos returned to his suite an hour before midnight. He made a cup of strong coffee to stay alert. Two late nights and long days were taking their toll. Alma stayed in the bedroom with Maya until the streets were empty and nearby windows dark. At 11:40 p.m., Nikos gently carried the old woman to his car, again as if she were fragile glass in an armload of lambskins. He clicked her car door shut and waited, watching to make sure no one was watching in turn. Their luck held. He and Alma simultaneously slipped into their front seats, and two doors closed as one. Under a cloudless, moonless sky, bright with the spilled Milky Way, Nikos drove again to Delphi. They zipped past the museum where Nikos's friend was certain to be sleeping. They drove a minute farther and pulled into the parking lot closest to the Omphalos, the smoother one, outside, not the beehive, bee-covered stone in the Delphi Museum. The place was empty, profoundly so. Maya struggled from the car without help, then took an arm each from Nikos and Alma. They headed for the Naval Stone, over ground well trammeled by hordes of fair-season pilgrims. With each slow step, clouds of their breath puffed in the sharp night air. Finally, the conical rock, a silhouetted half-egg shape, pointier side up, on a concrete plinth, rose before them to almost Maya's height. She touched the ancient marble. rough with slight fissures and striated with slightly raised, lighter-colored dikes. Its origins in worship of the bee goddess were displaced when Apollo brutally took over Delphi. The sacred stone hive became only a big belly button, a vestige of the severed umbilical cord, man freed from his obligations to women. This, too, would be explained through Maya's life story. May would see to it. Maya perched on a corner of the stone base to gather her strength. Nikos left mother and daughter to commune, as long as needed, and returned to his car. Alma had been well prepared for this throughout her life, but that made it no easier. Within minutes, she joined him, and in deep, heart-seared silence, they drove back to his suite. Alone in the dark, the old lady headed toward the oracle's caves at the base of Parnassus. Starlight tracked her ghost-white hair. The rest of her blended into craggy black rocks over which her feet felt their way with great difficulty. Cold seeped into her bones, but she kept one slow foot stepping ahead of another. Nikos and Alma waited in his kitchen, listening to classical music drifting quietly from the radio, neither speaking. Outside, all was calm, silent. Then it came. A single lightning strike near Parnassus filled the valley with a surreal split second of blue-white light. A prodigious thunderbolt rattled glass, jolted homes, and rustled trees down to the sea. Everyone in Criso woke up, if not from the burst and blast, then from others shaking them up, panicked about what had happened and why. The heavens, in contrast, returned to a deeper silence than before. Flickering pinpoints of starlight continued their slow dance through the vast void of space. No more lightning struck from clear skies. No more cracks of Zeus's thunderbolt shook the night. Criso was left in restless sleep until dawn. Nikos hurried to his brother's house. He argued that the thunderbolt had to be a natural phenomenon, not a stray missile strike or angry god. Let the police investigate, he insisted. All others should stay inside rather than run out willy-nilly to do what? Elena, a sensible soul despite her love of gossip, soon spread his advice through her extensive grapevine. A police officer drove to Delphi and talked to the night guard inside the museum. He reported that the lightning had struck so close to him that it blinded his closed eyes awake. The thunder shook his heart out of beat, making him struggle to breathe. After he caught his wind, he dared to search outside a few paces beyond the entrance. He saw nothing. He smelled ozone from the huge electric zap. The officer shone his flashlight toward the mountain and saw nothing untoward through the blackness. There was no one up there, the night guard assured him, alive or dead. The two stood guard together, expecting some curious villagers to come snooping, but Greek superstition kept them at bay. At dawn, the morning shift police officer arrived to take over. At first light, he walked with the night guard to where the lightning had struck. It had shattered a piece off Parnassus, leaving a dark scar near the entrance to the oracle's caves. At their feet, a shape had been burned into the rock, leaving a dark shadow that looked like a person vaporized by the Hiroshima or Nagasaki blasts. The guard raced to Criso's bakery, the first open shop, to tell what he'd found. Word spread to the next and next shops as they opened until the town was afire with his news. Nikos woke from a few hours of sleep on Spiro's sofa and rose to serve coffee and olive-soaked eggs at his brother's crowded taverna. He deflected the wildest speculations with quiet comments that sent laughter rippling through the taverna. What if a thunderbolt made a human shape on the ground? If a man had a birthmark on his backside the shape of a jet plane, would that make him an airport? Should he radio for clearance to sit down? That afternoon, Nikos excused himself from the chatter to drive to Thessaloniki, ostensibly alone, ostensibly on business. He spun along a single-lane highway that wound around mountain flanks. Encountering few other vehicles, the remoteness of the area and the stasis of winter reassured him in a bleak way. Alma soon dared to sit up in the front passenger seat with her hair and face uncovered. Half an hour out of Crisol, a silver Mercedes approached at high speed. Its two sunglassed men saw Nikos's passenger. Instantly, the car lurched with a pump of the brakes, then screeched around a curve. "Stop!" Alma shouted. Nikos pulled onto the narrow shoulder overlooking a steep, brambled embankment. The Mercedes made a fast U-turn at the next widening of the road and quickly caught up with Nikos's car, in which he was now traveling alone. The men dogged him and thumped into his bumper, forcing him to pull over. Both men emerged from the Mercedes. The driver, a trim client of Armani and Berluti, had white hair. His big, swarthy companion sported a brush cut shorn in three stripes rising from his ears. He wore a neck brace and the left arm in a sling under his jacket, while the sleeve hung empty. He approached Nikos's door, his right hand pointing a small gun with a big silencer, waving Nikos to get out. Nikos complied quickly. The driver rounded Nikos's car and peered into the front passenger seat. Empty. "Where is she?" the driver demanded with an Italian-British accent. Nikos shook his head and raised his hand. "No English." Impatiently, the driver asked in beginner's Greek, "Pou ine yineka?" His big partner peered through the stained glass window of the rear driver's side door. Nikos looked puzzled. The goon repeated, "The woman, you idiot." Nikos asked in Greek, "What woman?" "Pavla, Jala, you tell me." The big man opened the rear door, kicked it wide open with his foot, and phthook, fired a shot into the dark leather satchel on the floor. His partner flinched in surprise and hissed furiously. "We take her alive," the goon muttered. "Yeah, yeah," as he pulled the satchel out of the car, opened it, and scattered Nikos's neatly packed clothing and business papers on the ground. Nikos shook his head fearfully and said in Greek, "No woman, I have no woman. My wife, she is dead 3 years and 2 months, God keep her." The driver walked to the rear of the car and banged the trunk. "Open it." Nikos did so, revealing nothing but two lambskins and a pillow. The men pawed through, then looked at each other. Nikos said slowly in Greek, not wanting to repeat it, "There was a woman in the car that just speeded past me." He zoomed one hand quickly past another. "Similar car. You saw it, yes?" They leapt into their vehicle and tore off, tires spitting out shoulder gravel and squealing onto asphalt. Nikos picked up his clothing and papers scattered on the ground. He stuffed them into his satchel and threw them into the trunk. "Now what?" He looked over the nearby embankment, steep and scrubby with dark evergreens. He walked a few paces down the road, thought better of it, and got into the car. Should he drive back to look for Alma? Should he wait? For how long? For 10 minutes, he continually checked his watch in the rearview mirror. Finally, she clambered up the hillside, disheveled and muddied, dragging her overnight case by its shoulder strap. She tucked into the back seat of the car and gasped, "Drive, please." Nikos did. "What happened?" she asked. He told her, briefly. When he said they were looking for a Pavla or Jala, she closed her eyes hard. She closed them harder when he told of the shot. After he finished, she said, "You handled it perfectly. I'm beyond grateful and deeply sorry to have endangered you this way." Nikos shook his head. "They are fools." Alma smiled. "And you, may I write, are very good and very smart. I should have known they'd hear within hours of Mother's death and be on their way. Grief distracted me, and I honestly thought we'd have this day clear. I'll hide until we make Litokoro. If we encounter them again and they force you to stop, we're in terrible trouble." "Do not worry. I'll get you there," Nikos said. They spoke no more as he drove with jaw clenched and his eyes achingly alert to every vehicle on the road, all, fortunately, for naught. At twilight, Litokoro shone in the distance as if the Pleiades had been dropped onto the hem of Mount Olympus's green-black gown. Up close, Litokoro sat postcard perfect, a Greek village of 7,000 souls on the hillside below Zeus's craggy peak. The car bumped over cobblestone streets to an unassuming house at the back of town. Alma said, "Nikos, how can I thank you?" Nikos shrugged. "Stay alive." She laughed. "I will. I could get some tea for you here and leave it with May if you'd like." His eyes crinkled sweetly. "Thank you. I pray for you." The door of the house opened for Alma. She hurried to it, and as she vanished within, turned back to lightly blow him a kiss. Nikos wheeled freely on his way. He soon sat in Thessaloniki drinking ouzo and eating olives at the house of an old chum, his wife and several others. "Look at this olive, this perfect olive," his friend said in Greek, holding one up. "I have an endless supply for you. They will love them in America." Nikos shrugged. "Perhaps. You know I deal in quality, not volume. My clients pay top dollar for the very best." "These are good." "Good? They are magnificent. You take my olives to America. You sell them for me." Nikos grinned. "America, America, the answer to all your dreams, the place you love to hate. I will try, but no promises." Larry's receptionist, a motherly-looking woman, sat at the end of a broad hallway lined with busy offices, conference rooms, post-production, and viewing areas. The brass plate on her L-shaped desk read Nora. She kept a tidy work area and zone of calm around herself and Larry. Nora looked up and saw the problem coming. Randy Tellman's tall frame looped toward her, holding a large video camera on his shoulder, filming as he approached. His polished suit was more business school and camera jockey, his every move more geek than gainly. He pointed his weapon at light fixtures, snooped into open office doors, scanned posted notices, and zoomed in on minor building details. Employees caught in his sweep laughed in surprise at the camera and, as he continued on, rolled their eyes in disbelief. Nora quickly buzzed Larry at his desk, his head down, catnapping on an arm. Not moving his head, he reached with his other hand to push the speakerphone button. "Larry," she whispered urgently, "Randy's coming. He's videoing." Larry jerked upright. "He's what?" His door swung open without a knock, and in came Tellman's recording eye, prying into Larry's domain. "What the hell are you doing, Randy?" Larry demanded. "Trying it," the tall man said, continuing to record. "And that's Randolph J. Tellman III to you," he laughed. "It's not just that handheld shots are a thing, giving shows an immediate look, a real happening feel, but a fresh guy, fresh to the job, gives it a whole new look. I want what I'm showing you." He shifted the camera off his shoulder, causing a stack of papers on the desk to hit the floor. Larry groaned. Without acknowledging the spill, Tellman put the camera down on the nearest chair. New faces, lots of them, young and hot. The latest everything, topics never touched before, like what's news to those who don't check in, don't keep up, don't know what's up or down, because they're making up and down. It's coming together, just watch. Larry rubbed a hand over his weary face and sighed, then said emphatically, "This is the news, Randy. This is serious business." Stabbing the air, he continued, "Not social commentary, candid camera, trend of the month, news. We do a lot of handheld and mobile shots, and they work fine when it's all we've got. But we're not going all Instagram crude for news on the fly. We're rock solid, and we can use all the rock solid shots we can get. This bouncy stuff is powerful, like jalapeno peppers, and sickening, literally, to a lot of people. Not a main ingredient. Yeah, but I love it. And you don't know hot shit from nothing, man. We gotta lead, gotta set the trend." "We're all fed up with the bullies and bastards and Larry closed his eyes to gather himself. Leaning forward, looking intently at Tellman, he said, "The edict from on high is to integrate and to be more compelling, and to me that means to be real and deep and holistic. We need clear operating principles, not just a grab bag of cheap tricks." "So, the operating principle is big, beautiful, handheld cameras all the time, our signature look, like we're out roaming everywhere, even when we're here and in studio, you know, that moving look that's on top of what's new, even before it's new. Know what I mean?" Larry rolled his eyes. Randy continued, "We got pizzazz and we don't miss a thing." Larry pointed to the camera and said, "Tell you what, you show that exact footage to Uncle Al, then get back to me and tell me what he thinks. And tell him that this big pile on my desk is all your ideas. A new one every minute, a dime a dozen. I've never seen more razzmatazz, limp excuses for content in my life. And all this paper, all these website printouts?" If you look at the links I send you, like every 5 minutes, I wouldn't have to go all antique on you and print captures of all the web pages, because you're not out of the whole paper news world, so read away, dude, it's what you do. I don't look at these, Larry said calmly. The first draft of them made clear that I just need to organize them in neat piles so I have room to work. But they keep snowing down. Spare me, damn it, you're killing me. Randy laughed. No way, Lair. I'm polishing you up, making you look better than ever. He lifted the camera and pointed at Larry, videoing as he backed out the door. And I'm going to make you look better yet, just you watch. Nora discreetly closed the door on Larry, leaving him blessedly alone again. He collapsed behind his desk and held his despairing head in both hands. Videoed in the middle of this mess, he thought. This incompetence. It looks like hell. I look like hell. Got to stop him. I've got to get back to my neat, smooth world. But how? Pulled the sachet Maya gave him out from under his shirt and sniffed it. Peripherals, he heard her say. What's missing? Where was she, anyway? Arrested and imprisoned near Jeddah, May told him, then smuggled to Greece. Why wasn't she rushing back to this safer, if not saner, part of the world? I need to talk with you, damn it, Maya. I need some definition, some help. I mean, do high school dreams count? My naive Citizen Kane dream? Some cutting-edge, cut-to-the-quick, wake-em-up story, huh? I thought I'd chase fire trucks for a few years, see it all from higher and higher up, and voila! Boy genius, tells it like it is, makes some kind of new sense out of the chaos. He stared angrily at his overburdened desktop and muttered, this miserable mess in the middle, then thinking, and beyond it, there's no sense, no pattern, just more and more mess. It really is going to do me in. He lifted his leg to rub his calf through light wool slacks. He rolled up his pants to feel the swollen skin over the lump by a shin bone and winced from the dull pain. Damn you, just go away, you hear? You and Randy both, you rotten, infiltrating little lumps. Stop, stop, stop. His shoulders slumped. A long sob shuddered out of him. He abruptly let go of his leg and forced himself to sit up. His thoughts spun on. Oh, you jerk. Self-pity's the worst. You've got choices. If I'm tired, so what? Pay attention to it. It's telling you something. You're not the only one tired of this bullshit. You're in the driver's seat. Oh, you used to be. You've got a front row seat at least, so use it. We're all fed up with the bullies and bastards and elected basket cases, so what do? We do more, faster, bigger, pile on the shock schlock until the whole world's in a titillated, addicted tizzy. Except the smart ones, they're turning it off. It's too much and it's not enough, like it ever really was. Did I really think that what I was saying and doing and pulling together was the end-all and be-all? As good as it gets? Good God, no. So, what do you want? All those theys who buy ad time, pay my salary. He took a breath. No, to hell with them. What do I want? For my purposes, for my dream, for my telling. I want to know what happened before it happened, how the setup made it possible. Inevitable. Context. Yeah, I want more context, damn it. Larry quickly pulled open his desk drawer and found Maya's piece of paper. Point number one, news and systemic context. Gaia Incorporated. Gaia Incorporated, the incorporated, embodied business of living systems, bottom line bioproductivity within the human economy context and separate from it. The artifice of separation, ignoring core peripherals, externalities that define the center of what matters and how to deal with it. And what are we doing? Focusing ever narrower, looking ever more superficially, cutting out more and more of the context, going for good guy, bad guy, bang bang stuff, all the sexy without the setup, without the whole big structure and context. My God, Maya, it's so big, so obvious, so missing. Larry leapt for the phone and hit the Nora button. Excitedly, he said, get me Fran in Manila. Wake her up. I don't care. I've got to talk to her. Oh, man, Larry. Fran groaned into her cell phone as she leaned over in bed to click on the bedside lamp. In the blast of light, under tousled hair, she scrunched her eyes, working every age line of her 40 years. She sat up in the rumpled bed, naked, with a solid build and generous breasts. In good light, she could be handsome, if not pretty, with an edgy, compelling energy. Her smallish Manila hotel room could have been in any upscale place. The bedside clock radio said 1:03 a.m. A round table held her closed laptop, a dormant beehive ringed by spiral-bound notebooks, printed papers, and overflowing ashtrays.
Two water glasses smudged with fingerprints, lip prints, and dregs of red wine sat on the mantel of a fake fireplace. An empty wine bottle lay dead on the carpet. A man's smooth brown hand slid under Fran's arm, groping for her breast. "Stop it," she said, swacking at him with her free hand. "It's my boss." The man, a 30-something, well-made Filipino, reluctantly withdrew and pouted behind Fran. She continued into the phone. "It's one in the bloody morning and my report's almost done. I'm not going anywhere right now, doing anything, seeing anyone. I don't care what just blew up, broke, or fell from the sky. Fran, I'm sorry, but I've got to talk. It's important." She ran a hand through her hair. "You all right?" "No, I'm painted into a corner here and I can't wait for the paint to dry to get out. Randy just outdid himself. He's driving me to, I don't know, suicide. If he ever wangles a production budget out of his sugar uncle, we're dead. He's running full tilt on empty. It's all reactive, who's looking at me, looking at you, looking at me stuff. I keep telling them that faster, harder, younger, glitzier, now freaking jumpier. They're not good enough. I want different. I want a different operating principle. And I know what it is now. I've got it figured. It's sort of retro, but with all our new setup and integration, it's where we've got to go. So slow down a bit, at least until I get into overdrive with you. Listen, I met someone, and she's got me thinking, I mean really thinking, about what's wrong, what's missing in the big picture, and it's so obvious. The answer's in the peripherals, the structure and context that define every story, not just the bottom line. We've got to get back to that. We've got to focus hard on the peripherals, the high, the low, the wide peripherals. Fran laughed. Focus on the peripherals. Isn't that an oxymoron? Larry chuckled. Maybe, but I'm good at it. The old lady's absolutely right. What old lady? I'll tell you when you're back, maybe introduce you to her. Right now, we've got to talk about what she said and wrote. She's brilliant.
Larry, what's the randy-dandy slipped into your coffee? Larry laughed again. Nothing, I got herbs. He felt the pebble in the sachet with a little stone. Fran, I'm dead sober and I want you to try this. We've got to stop going for the central, core, obvious stuff, chasing fire trucks. We can pick up on that all over the place. Everyone can. Hit the edges, go looking farther into context than you've ever looked before. Go blind, go exploring. Larry, 20 years into snooping, this old hound ain't stumbling around blind anywhere. No, not blind, I don't mean that. I mean looking deeper into the ecological, economic, psychological, and demographic contexts. It's got a name, Gaia Incorporated, the embodied bigger economic world and how everything we do runs in it. Fran said, oh, God, you've gone all Greta on me, and that's great, God knows. But what you're talking about are things that make the mess in the middle, you know what I mean? What I really mean is that the immediate peripheral and mess in this middle, are you listening, is that I'm buck naked in Snoozeville with a touch of wine lag. Ah, geez, I'm sorry, the binds here are getting worse. If I don't come up with something, the rent-a-nephew's going to do us all in. So let's get practical. How's this going to work? Connect it to the fire truck I'm chasing here. Okay, I'll wing it. Sex tourism in the Far East. You go to Bangkok, Jakarta, Manila, wherever the fire is still out of control. You go to villages where the girls come from. You talk to the local pimps and fly-in Johns. You do the update. That's all obvious, central. You do it better than anyone else, but it's still just the mess in the middle. I want you to tie it to land use. Have you done that? You've done the economics, I know that's a given, except the eco of economics and ecologics means home, right? And these girls are from homes. So link them, link the ecology and economy of their homes. Tie it to demographics, the number of young people there, and their place on the land, in their villages, as extras to sacrifice to the cities and the big bad world. Then there's the psychology. Fran said, yeah, okay, I'm getting it. I've touched on some of this, but not the eco-freako stuff, that's separate. But it isn't. It's about which people fit where, and that's ground level. I mean, ground level stuff. It sounds like a peripheral, but it's the bottom line. You know, like drought in Syria leading to the endless fucking bombing there, millions of displaced, tens of thousands of dead. And it goes back to the land, the water, the markets, everything those people used to do to make lives for themselves based on Gaia Incorporated. But we don't say that when we make these new reports. The Gaia part, it's our operating principle. Fran sighed. Oh, boy. No, I haven't talked to any ecologists and farmers, for God's sake. And who knows what they'd say. I guess that's reason enough to cover them, since I doubt any other mainstream media is covering it. Definitely not what those keen on news about sex trafficking are looking for. Psychologists, demographers. Yeah, that makes sense, but listen, I'm just about wrapped up, and I've got a decent reporter, well, no worse than usual. Your usual is great, and you know it. Now I want you to do the unusual, so we can show these bastards where the news is going, what the future looks like. And it's not the randy-dandy shit he's pelting me with. I want you to hit the peripherals, go to the edges, like you've never done before, and file me the best bit of context reporting done since Rosebud hit the screen. What? Citizen Kane, remember? The whole thing was about what was missing, and when that little piece of the puzzle showed up at the end, everything made sense. It's about the little, seemingly peripheral details that are really core, about not being so busy chasing the news like Kane was to overlook the importance of tiny moments that tell you how things operate in the snow globe and what really matters. You know the Citizen Kane story, right? Fran stayed snuggled against her backside. She muffled the phone speaker with one hand and pushed him away with the other. Come on, back off! He pulled away and ran his hand up her outer thigh. She held it there. Huh? Larry puzzled.
Company, Larry. I've got company and he's a pest. You too, sweetheart, but I love you. And yes, I'm something of a cane expert, thanks to you. So listen, ecologists, shrinks, number spinners, demographers, farmers outstanding in their fields, rosebud growers, cutters, sniffers, sellers... Larry laughed. Great. It's going to work. Trust me. Thanks, hey. Bye. Fran clicked off the phone and turned to her bed partner. He sulked, eyes dark, and said, You call me a pest. Well, you are, when you come on like that while I'm talking with the boss. So here's the scoop. The boss man says I need the whole bed right to the edges. He moved in to kiss and fondle her. She pulled away. No, I'm serious. You've got to go. I've got to get some sleep. I've got to... Come on, baby. His eyes smoldered. No, I thought I was done, but I've got a pile more work to do, a kid to get home to in a couple days, you understand? I'm out of time and right out of the mood now, too. I got a mood, too, baby, you understand? His face hardened, the fingers of his free hand itching to curl into fists. No, don't, she said, matching his hard eyes. Don't even think it. Then she dropped her voice to say, What have you got to think about now is that pretty girl at the samosa stand, the one you called sister? He grinned. I didn't want to make you jealous. I mean, she's hot, let me tell you. He jumped up to pull on his dress slacks and white shirt. As he tucked in the ends and buckled his belt, Fran said, So I'm your new sister. Go make her jealous. Ha, he snorted, shoving his feet into sandals. Standing before an entryway mirror, he finger-combed his hair. I'm sorry, Fran said softly. Without a reply, he left, slamming the door. Peripheral, she muttered as she twisted the deadbolt shut. Thunk. Definitely not my strength.
The next night, Fran worked until late on her sex trade story in the editing room of a Manila TV production facility. She spliced in new video and sound bites gathered that day in an effort to contextualize the story the way Larry had requested, to present the snow globe around the sled, so to speak, where the sled was the deportation trial of a U.S. citizen for his murky case involving sex trafficking. Damn, she muttered periodically. It wasn't working. Some of the new stuff was great, especially the unexpectedly brilliant analysis by a local ecology professor and, of all things, a lead from her to another woman researcher turning plastic and metal from garbage dumps into steel, which drew deft lines from current resource extraction to sex exploitation, but she'd have to redo the story to make it fit. Larry's point exactly, she thought wryly. The problem was that the new telling exposed, perhaps dangerously, the reasons behind the reasons for the world order, cutting deep into who controlled what, including the news, which isn't supposed to get snoopy about who drives and benefits from the state of the economy. Still, this different way of interviewing certainly beat cheap, easy streeters, asking people what they knew and how they felt about something. The thinking and the work of it were okay, a change from the usual well-oiled news reporting machine she'd become, but the result was radically different, which is what Larry wanted. But did the big cheese and the little Randy Mouse nibbling at it? Was she wasting her time, since she'd have to spend another week shaping up this new spin? Would she and Larry get their knuckles wrapped? Would she have to backtrack to the original report she'd almost completed? She looked up to a row of clocks on the wall above the editing console, set to local time in London, Athens, Delhi, Hong Kong, Los Angeles, and New York. It was 3:16 p.m. in Baltimore. There was no question what she'd do. On her tablet, she typed the Skype button, then drummed her fingers impatiently while waiting to connect. Finally, her face lit into a wide smile. "Hey, darling, happy birthday, my beautiful girl. Happy Feb 12, 13 years wonderful." "Hi, Mom," the aunt said flatly into her smartphone screen. Her build was as solid as Fran's, minus Mom's 27 hard-living years. A new blue T-shirt bumped over developing breasts, bearing a small gold mandala of kanji symbols and a Chinese monk circled by a Vienna Buddhist retreat crest. She sat on the side of her unmade bed, a pink and white frilly jumble in her pink, white, and fuzzy all-American little girl bedroom. Stuffies galore, shoulder to shoulder on every flat surface, kept her company. Family photos and cartoon character frames lined the dresser top. The aunt picked up a snapshot of herself at age 6 in Mickey Mouse ears at Disneyland, giggling on Fran's lap. "Aw, you're down, sweetheart. I'm sorry. You got my present, though, I can see." "Yeah." "So it's okay? Fits well enough? Color fine?" "Yeah, it's definitely me. Is that a strike or a ball?" "The shirt's the real thing, sweetheart. Right from the top cheese at the Diana Monastery." "Well, commercial wing, charity division." The aunt said nothing. "So this call's supposed to cheer us up, bridge the gap. What can I do from here?" "Nothing. Where's here?" "Still Manila. I texted you yesterday. You didn't get it?" "Heard the ping. Didn't check." "Oh. It's not my birthday on that side of the world. It's like over. Done." "Yeah, well, here doesn't count. It's the 12th there where my heart is. You were born right about now. You know that?" "Man, I was there and screaming. Toughest. Absolutely best day of my life." The Anne managed a wry half-smile. "The Anne?" "Yeah." "I'm here 2 more days and I'm home. As fast as jets fly. We'll celebrate then. Twice as hard. Big party, sleepover, night out, whatever you want." "How are today's plans going?" "They're not. Dad and Cindy are taking me to a stupid movie." "What happened to the party?" "Cinderella wanted a stupid dress-up thing. No boys, and get this. She said she'd hire us a clown." "Oh, wow." I said, "No fucking way." "You didn't." "Uh-huh. Oh, boy. I mean dress-ups and a clown. I'm not a little girl." The aunt swept everything off the top of her dresser with a quick slide of her forearm. "I don't need this shit." Landed with a clatter. "What's that?" Fran asked. "Nothing." A framed wedding photo of her dad and Cindy landed face up. It had doubled as a Christmas card with season's greetings floating over their heads. Her dad wore a tuxedo, an amiable-looking executive, pudgy in his satin cummerbund. Cindy was a plump, painted Christmas angel, perfect for atop the decorator tree in the background. The aunt cracked the picture glass under the heel of her sneaker. "You okay?" "Yeah, I'm fine. How are you?" "Tired, honey. Wish I was home. It kills me not to be there with you. I've got to make some changes, big changes." Her phone ringing punctured the last words. She checked who was calling. "Damn, I've got to answer it. It's Larry. I'm sorry, sweetheart. I love you, my gorgeous girl. You hear? I love you. And we'll have a happy, happy birthday together next week, okay?" "Sure. Bye." The aunt clicked off her phone. She still held the photo of herself and her mom at Disneyland. Fighting tears, she took it from the frame and methodically tore it into tiny pieces. Larry sat back in his office chair, his dark-circled eyes rising like Kilroy over the battlefield of his desk. On speakerphone, he said, "Looks like you're it, Fran. What have you got from there?" "About what?" "The crash. Real mess. Rough terrain, I know, but you're closest." "What crash? I've been nose to the grindstone, eyes on the big white edges. West Orient jet down on Mount Sikapu, just north of you. Get on a rescue flight if you can. Rent something otherwise." Fran groaned. "Oh, shit. Sorry, Fran. I'm glad it's you, though, because I want this covered the way we discussed. Context, context, context. Literally understanding what that means. Who and what stands under it. The whole equation from the math to the aftermath. The big salami here wouldn't know a big picture, bottom line, peripheral if it bit him. But to hell with him." Fran laughed. "I'm not sure I would either. What's the little wiener want?" bunch of cheap new cub reporters flying around like buckshot doing handheld shots to where all puking, bringing the reality TV world to the news. I mean, it's made inroads enough, but he wants a whole new level. We've got to show them. Go light on the bloody stuff, the obvious crap. Get the ground level story about the crash zone. Look for the ecologic, economic, and psychological factors that everyone else steps over and misses, but define the heart of it. And when you check right to the edges in the last scene, don't toss out any old sleds called Rosebud. Fran interrupted. Oh, for God's sake, someone should burn that damn thing. But wait, they did, and that was the end of it. And then the lights go on, Larry said. Movie's over, story's told, and you get it. Damn, I wish I could be there. This is exciting. In principle, Larry, it's thrilling. In fact, dear heart, it sucks. Not this approach or that, but I told the Anne I'd be home in a few days. So give it at least a week, okay? You should be back by month end. Fran sighed deeply, her eyes blank. That's 2 weeks, more. Larry said, listen, I'm sorry, I don't plan the news. Well, someone should, damn it. Let's get some control at the causal level. What's all this react stuff? Larry laughed. So let's show some causal understanding at least and blow every other report out of the water. Win prizes, Fran, proof that it works. Don't worry about filing right off. We'll tap other sources for the quick and dirties. I'm really glad you're there. You're the best. The end. Birthday dinner, Cindy sang out in perfect pitch, the large lady in purple satin and lace dress decreeing the opera begin. She, Ralph, and their two boys, aged 4 and 6, seated themselves at the dining table laden with Disney character balloons, favors, and plastic table settings complete down to napkin rings. The boys wore their Sunday best, slacks, dress shirts, and ties. Yann emerged from her trashed hideout, where she'd cleared a few more surfaces and tore up a few more photos. Her navel winked from between a tiny black skirt and tight red sweater. She wore stylish boots, wild lacquered hair with red streaks, and gothic face. Ralph's eyes popped at her curves, costume, and ghoulish makeup. Cindy blurted, "Oh my goodness!" in her Shirley Temple voice. Now, don't you just wish you had that dress-up party with your friends? We could have had so much fun modeling all kinds of clothes and looks and Mardi Gras get-ups. God help us all, Ralph muttered under his breath. Cindy produced a platter of Ralph's barbecued hamburgers, the Anne's favorite, and done to perfection. Pass, the Anne said, flopping herself into the chair. Pardon? Cindy asked. No more dead cows, thank you. I'm giving them up for Lent and forever after that. Ralph sighed. Oh, come on, you're going all trendy on me. Can I barbecue you an egg? The Anne rolled her eyes. I wish you'd told me, Ralph said. I could have made veggie burgers, you know, or those almost things. Little dead soys and lab-grown whatevers. Yeah, I like those. The Anne flashed a fake grin at Cindy, who was spreading mustard and ketchup on buns for her boys. Dead soys, the 6-year-old burst out laughing. Beans, he explained to his little brother, then made farting sounds. Dead beans. Ew, stinky, the little one shrieked, holding his nose. Shh, Cindy demanded quickly with sharp looks and stiffened posture. The boy's silliness stopped, and she kept getting strict check through a tense meal. After, she cleared the table, turned on the lights, and brought in the Anne's ice cream cake. 13 candles lit the way for Minnie Mouse's pink-trimmed, all-icing sports car. Cindy led the singing of Happy Birthday to You, her voice a lovely liquid stream through otherwise bumpy terrain. Ralph took a couple of photos, then Cindy arranged a shot of the Anne blowing out the candles with Ralph and the boys behind her. She let the candles burn shorter and shorter while holding her half-brother's back from puffing at them. When Ralph and Cindy were nearly as riled as the boys, she limply blew at the blaze. 6 candles snuffed. The older boy teased, "The Anne's got boyfriends, lots of kissy boyfriends." She quickly licked her thumb and forefinger and killed one flame with a pinch and sizzle, to the boy's amazement. Ralph said, "Don't, The Anne." The Anne licked her fingers again and reached to nip more. Cindy lightly smacked her hand away. "The Anne, behave yourself. It's your birthday." The Anne got up. "Excuse me, I feel sick. I'm going to lie down in my room." Cindy shrugged exaggeratedly at Ralph, who made a big, puzzled face in return. The youngest son ate them so vigorously that he toppled off his chair. Both boys exploded in uncontrollable laughter and repeated the performance, complete with drunken falling. Cindy tried to stop them. Ralph watched, stunned and shaking his head. The noise and confusion in the dining room allowed the Anne to walk out the front door and down the street. She had no coat. She left her iPhone in Cindy's good care. Deanne's exit tripped the outdoor motion sensor lights, which lit a big, fairly new, upscale suburban home, its clipped yard and double garage blended with the neighbor's matching notions of perfect living. No one noticed her. Through chilly darkness, she dog-legged down several tree-lined streets to a similar house, a variation on the same theme. Curtains blanked every window with lights on behind all of them. She knocked on the door and waited. No one answered. She bing-bonged the doorbell and waited longer. She looked around. Next door, she could make out a dark, old gingerbread place with a sagging veranda set in midwinter brambles. Ooh, she shivered, hugging herself to keep warm. Witchy! She held her finger hard on the doorbell. Come on, come on, I'm freezing. An older teenage girl opened the door, letting loose the rich smell of pot and a battle of stereos from every room. She squinted through wide black pupils at Deanne. Hi, what's the password? It's my birthday. You're kidding. Deanne shook her head. All right, this is it. The young woman pulled Deanne in by the arm, kicked the door shut with her foot, and quickly locked it. The mingle and mayhem blasted hot and hazy before them, wasted kids in every room. What's your name? Deanne. Brianne? Whatever. So listen, Brianne, only one rule. Keep it down so the cops don't kill us before the old guys get home. When's that? Next week. We've been going for like 3 days. Fucking brilliant.
Next door, May worked at her dining table, looking old beyond age. The party pulsed beyond her windows while she scribed in blessed silence without her hearing aid in. She hummed the occasional snatch of something resembling song. Her handwritten notes found their way into the Mashioi file. When the telephone rang, Byron bounced and barked, signaling for her to put in her teeth and hearing aid. Her fingers with glossy red nails worked quickly this time, only 6 rings to, hello? Mrs. Singer-Jones, Nikos Platido here, he said loudly, in Thessaloniki. Yes, dear, I can hear you. How did it go? As planned, I think. I left Alma safe. And Mrs. Solari, I am sorry to tell you that your old friend is gone, apparently the way the good Lord intended. Bless you, Nikos. So difficult for you, all of you. Poor Maya. What time exactly did she die? 1:07 a.m. February 12th, Greek time. She was so brave, an angel. Alma, too. She is a nice lady, so much like her mother, it is amazing. We had a small incident leaving Chryso, but we made it safe to Litocharo. Good. How are you doing? Fine. I'm always fine. And you? I miss you, of course, but the young people next door keep checking to see if I'm okay. They think that if I run out of groceries, I'll phone the police or emergency. She chuckled. You can relax now, dear, and have a holiday. I'll see you in 10 days. I work here, too, yes. I have olives to ship and feta, worry beads, maybe even Olympus tea, if I can find a supplier. Mrs. Solari's last drink. Oh, no, Nikos, it is too rare. Don't waste your time. Oh, he paused. Okay, I will call you again before I fly home. Thank you, dear. Thank you for everything. And goodbye. By midnight, Deanne had no desire to know who she was or where. Perched on a stool at a bar, that was certain. Shoeless, with bare legs and tiny skirt riding up high on her thighs, yes. Too warm in her short sweater, but no change of tops available, and, even if there were, too hazy to do it. She took another toke of some wicked vape concoction and spun further into oblivion. Who handed it to her wasn't discernible through unfocused eyes. Leanne reached slowly, giggling at her own seemingly detached hand, aiming for a frosty bottle of beer put near her by a thoughtful person who had only drank half of it. She poured some of it into her mouth over her thirsty, grateful tongue and down her gullet. Some fizzed down her sweater, too, but who cared? Across the room, far from the aunt's sphere and thoughts, another tarted-up young woman turned a cold eye on a taut young man, his muscled frame and crotch bulging for her, and said, "Good night, asshole." He reached sloppily for her. "You can't go, you're mine, you hear me? That's not a question, bitch." So watch this, jerk. She waved in his face, then dared turn on his heel and leave. She walked out of the room. She walked out of the house. She walked down the street into the night. He tried to stumble on drunken feet after her, but bumped hard into a door frame in the way. He raged blindly. Don't turn on a fucking Ferrari, you fucking whore, unless you're going to go for the fucking ride. Someone laughed. Fucking Ferrari, in your dreams. Someone else said, you're not even a fucking Jeep. Fucking dinky toy, a sweet-voiced young woman added, cracking up everyone close and sober enough to hear. He walked to the bar, took the bottle from the aunt's hand, and said, quit drinking my beer, you slut. She didn't respond. He finished it, then says, I'm talking to you, slut face. You listen to me. She turned to him with blank eyes, nobody home. He noticed a dartboard hung on a nearby wall and started angrily pulling the darts out of it. Play with me, he demanded of the aunt. She looked up and saw the dartboard for the first time in hours. She giggled. Where'd that come from? I said, fucking play darts with me. Holding half a dozen little feathered spikes, he walked across the room to where his date had left him. He threw a dart out the door she took, a hard whizzing effort. It lodged in a wall in the next room. He threw the next dart at the laughter behind him. It glanced off a Tiffany lampshade. He quickly made three more furious, lucky misses at furnishings and walls, then, with the last dart, lined up the Anne and let it fly at her. It zinged true and stuck deep into her thigh. She barely flinched, didn't look down. Someone noticed her lack of reaction and laughed. Look at that, a cartoon, man. Others looked and snickered. No one helped. A thick gob of bright blood oozed up and slowly drooled down her thigh. Hey, Brienne, she heard the girl who had answered the door say. Wake up, look at your leg. The Anne looked down. Wow, she mouthed. She touched the thick liquid, tasted it. Blood, she whispered. Gradually her rubbery hand fumbled the dart out of her skin, out of the leg, and dropped it to the floor. Dark red drops splattered beside it. She reached for the beer bottle and tipped it up to her mouth. Empty. Damn. She reached further for another unopened bottle. With concerted effort, she twisted the cap off of it and sloshed a drink into and over herself. Very good. The dart thrower tripped into a side table, then vomited it on a mess of snacks and smoked dregs. What the fuck you doing, man? A big guy said. You're out of here. An even bigger fellow hoisted and bounced him from the house. He stumbled down the street, as nameless and faceless as he'd entered. The aunt crawled behind the bar and slept there until mid-morning. She woke up cold and stiff, her mouth disgusting and her head aching off the Richter scale. She found a bathroom. Sitting on the toilet, she held her head in her hands, elbow on her thighs. Holy shit, she said, seeing a track of dried blood in the swollen source of it. What's that? She got up and flushed the toilet, startling herself when she saw the girl in the huge oversink mirror. Her makeup had slid down her face, more ghoulish now than goth. She wiped smudged mascara from sad cheeks onto grubby fingers. Holding her wild hair back, she searched in a drawer for an elastic or clip. A scrunchie surfaced, gaudy with sequins. Sure, why not? Party on. She rummaged further for a clean face cloth, but gave up, and grabbed a dried one hanging from a hook by the sink. She splashed cold water at her face, then wet the cloth and put it over her throbbing thigh, water coursing down to her bare feet. She gulped cool drafts straight from the tap. Oh, she sighed. Water, I love you, she laughed wryly. At least I love something. Next, the cloth scrubbed away the painted lady and found the kid beneath. She chose the newest toothbrush of half a dozen at hand, loaded up toothpaste, then hesitated. She ran her tongue around her teeth, grimaced a yuck, and brushed hard. Baggy jeans and sweatshirt hung on hooks on the bathroom door. They fit over her skimpy outfit and then some. Instant little girl lost in them. A makeup drawer yielded some burgundy lipstick, which she twisted onto pouting lips and made her haughtiest glamour face. She found life in the house by following the sounds of a boiling electric kettle and the clink of spoons stirring sugar and more sugar into stiff instant coffee.
In a trashed, filthy kitchen, half a dozen kids sat nursing hangovers around a table, wincing at every sound, loud breathing included. "Hey, here comes the dartboard," croaked a ragged young man. "Brianne, the human bullseye," her hostess added. "Is that what this red thing is?" Deanne asked, circling her fingers over sore thigh. They laughed uproariously, holding their fragile heads. She joined them for 2 more days. On the elm-lined street in front of Maid's old home, a light blue sedan pulled up and crunched onto the gravel driveway. By daylight, the house's gingerbread trim, broad veranda, and entangled rose trellises spoke of former wealth and house-proud care. Its paint peeled in bits and chunks now. Its hand-wrought details fell away. The house could be restored with much elbow grease. Another decade of neglect would finish it. The driver, a big-haired blonde woman in sunglasses and beige pantsuit, got out. She carried a canvas tote. On May's sloping porch, she listened through the front door to the faint singing, more like wailing, coming from within. She smiled fondly, then wrapped a serpent-shaped brass knocker. In the living room, Byron barked at May, her black wig askew in her head and teeth atop the piano. Her black rubber boots over skinny legs worked the pedals. Chartreuse hose matched her sweater. Turquoise sheath skirt matched stone beads. She continued to play and sing. Byron growled and pulled at her boots, forcing her to stop and listen. The rapper sounded again, louder this time. "Ah, I see. Or rather, hear. Good lad, Byron." May's teeth found her mouth as she shuffled to the door. "Alma," she said, peering at the blonde woman in sunglasses who smiled broadly. May clapped her hands. "Oh, I'm so pleased. Come in quick." Alma slipped in, removed her shades and wig, and shook out her hair. "Hello, dear May. I've got some D.C. business, always, so stopped by en route to thank you and to leave a small gift for Nikos. He was brilliant. We had a close call, far too close, and he saved me with ease. He said there was an incident. I'm sorry. He's a good man. I've been counting on him for, well, a long widowhood now. I knew you'd be safe with him. He left me in Litokhoro. I got there with no trouble, no eyes upon me, thank goodness. It's been harrowing nonetheless. Of course, poor dear. Would you like coffee? Tea? Tea, yes. Perhaps some of this." Alma pulled a small wooden box from her large purse. She slid the top of it open to reveal a neat row of cotton sachets rich with the smell of her mother's tea. "This is for you. I have another box for you to give to Nikos." May took the box and inhaled deeply. "The scent of Maya," she said, blinking back tears. "Maya forever." "My last cup was with her," Alma said. "We could have this one with her, too, if you wouldn't mind viewing one of her old films with me." "What a lovely idea. They're all in the basement, as you know. Fetch as many as you like while I fix the tea, the projector, screen, everything's there." May headed through her stacks of paperwork for her kitchen. Alma disappeared down a stairwell off the living room. The musty, dusty smell of the house grew thicker with each step down. A bare 100-watt light bulb threw garish shadows on floor-to-ceiling shelves heaped with the trappings of May's long years of teaching drama, music, and visual arts. Old props, painting equipment, music stands, and books filled every nook and leaned against one another. Masks peered through empty eyes. Drums had sat mute for decades. Hand-carved models of canoes and paddles lay beached long after gliding through an early television show. Slow mildew and quick spiders worked this dark world. An old film projector, like a small dinosaur, sat atop an antique white icebox about 4 feet tall. A tall metal tube leaned nearby, containing a rolled-up projector screen. Alma opened the rusty latch on the cabinet's top door to reveal a dozen round, galvanized canisters of film. She wiped the dust from a few rims, dust inside the icebox even, to reveal their titles written in May's bold hand. She chose 2, Maha Prajapati and Mary, considered them for a moment, then put Mary back. While Alma made 2 trips carrying the projector, screen, and film to the living room,
Mary prepared tea in her cramped kitchen, her notes covered an alcoved table and the top of a rounded 1950s fridge. Every other horizontal surface was covered with cooking implements, books, and stacks of dishes matted with greasy dust from long disuse. She had been an active hostess through her prime years, throwing great dinner parties for every artistic connection she could make from near and far. Her parents had done the same from their house down the street until her mother suddenly died of unshakable influenza and her father's heart gave out shortly after. May sold their home to pay off Irwin's gambling debts on the condition that he repent and reform. His promise lasted half a year. From being orphaned, that's how she felt, despite her advanced age, to retiring from teaching, then widowed a decade later, she gradually stopped making brilliant parties for people who meant to invite her in return, but seldom did. Old friends died, old neighbors left, newcomers moved in, too busy even for tea. As her research deepened to envelop her, she ate from the bags, cans, and boxes littering the narrow countertops, and from the fresh produce bin in the fridge. Maya had been her only at-home mealtime guest in 20 years, and she happily ate what May quickly and easily prepared. Nico squired May about several times a week to shop and to visit her beloved university library. She refused to get a computer and get onto the internet, sticking to her love of old primary sources and her trust of handwritten copies. She could order books and other materials on interlibrary loan, a system that had improved vastly over the decades, and the original she couldn't get in hand would be copied for her and printed relatively inexpensively compared to years ago, all part of the library's digitizing their collections of the old records she required. Some copies cost her dearly, but she never quibbled over the price of what was needed. Larry used to drop by every few months. Lately he'd taken to calling her every week or so, because she was getting so old, she guessed, although she still felt more like the solid woman she'd been than the lightweight crone reflected by mirrors. She took him to restaurants 2 or 3 times a year, but had never cooked for him. He'd had no taste of her former culinary prowess, and she spared him stories of her sparkling social life. Larry stayed in her thoughts as the water rumbled to a boil in the stovetop kettle. He didn't know about Maya yet. Poor Larry, he'd be upset. She put 2 Olympus tea bags into her brown Betty teapot and poured the boiling water onto them, releasing the delicate scent of faraway climes and a world of memories. She must let Larry know. In person, of course, soon. May set up the fine china cups and saucers that she and Maya had last used together. As she fumbled ginger snaps from a bag and tucked 2 onto each saucer, Alma popped her head into the kitchen and said, "I found everything we need, I think." "Good. Clear a spot on the sofa for yourself, will you? I'll be with you in a minute." In the living room, Alma moved a handful of current newspapers from sofa to floor and settled herself. The topmost newspaper, she noted, lay folded to an inside page and had a small rectangle clipped from it. In the kitchen, May poured the golden tea with pleasure and trembling hands. It snaked into the cups and, when she walked to the living room, rattled in their saucers. Lord Byron danced around her legs. Alma watched alertly, ready to rush to May's aid. But a noisy cup arrived safely in her hands, cookies neatly sogging up the sloshed tea. Alma said, "I haven't been so relaxed in days." May sat down in her old chair, mop dog snuggled at her feet. Alma continued, "I brought up just 1 film, so I won't interrupt you for long. We can watch as many as you like for as long as you like, dear. It will be wonderful to see your mother so young and lively." "I miss her," Alma sighed deeply, inordinately. Her eyes brightened with tears. "Life played her very different cards than it has me, and I mean that only in an assessing, not complaining way. She took part in and fashioned so many pivotal moments, while I seemed to be less connected, less able to act in definitive ways, as she did, to effect change. Without her, I feel rudderless, not ready yet to take the lead, as she did, or perhaps ever can." May shook her head.
Oh, Alma, you know her doubts, her grave concerns that she wasn't doing enough, even as she worked with Churchill, Gandhi, Mr. Bell, Einstein, Wallenberg, Bethune, Kennedy. Such a list, so many dreamers and doers, such disappointments, too, when madness and war overwhelmed the world, and she cried for every hurting soul and her inability to make, she thought, the slightest difference. She always felt that she could do more and better, despite knowing that she had planted endless seeds and nurtured a few to full fruition, none more important than you, Pavla, and Luna, her greatest successes and legacy. Still, she never gave up, May said. That's the only but. Alma struggled to smile. Oh, May, you're so right. Thank you. She took a sip of consoling tea. I can't tell you how much I need this. May watched her lovingly for a moment, then said, I miss her terribly, too. Alma nodded. Long seconds later, she asked, How is your work going? Very well, dear. I've covered most of the groundwork, which frees me, at last, to work on deductions and connections. Frees me to honor your mother's request, Dan, May's voice quavered. Look for a biographer. Alma said steadily, Yes, it worries me, too. We talked at length and agreed that the assignment of a biographer should take a natural course, unfolding without being forced. We'll keep it actively in mind, that is, but won't choose until the best person comes to light, him or herself. Now that Mother's wish is on the wind, it will work out. May closed her eyes and sighed deeply, wise to the end and beyond. Alma said, freeing you to work without interruption. So tell me, what deductions and connections are you making? May named several goddesses and ancient women identified differently in different locations and times that she was increasingly certain were one and the same. Alma knew the thrust of her research, so they spoke quickly and cryptically. May finished her tea and gave Byron her last half cookie. She concluded that within 5 years she would have the lineage whittled down to 300 core names under which all others could be arranged. What an undertaking, Alma said appreciatively, rising to close May's heavy red drapes with their clunky pull. All this work here and in your amazing head. The trick, May said, is to get it out so I don't take a stitch of it with me. But we all take treasures with us when we go. It can't be helped. Only resisted, May said, as her bony old hands expertly threaded Maya's mother's 1942 film into the projector sitting on the piano bench. The effort keeps us upright and progressing if we're lucky. How intact is the film? Alma asked, stooping to plug in the projector. May squinted closely at a section of celluloid. It's excellent. Time has been far kinder to it than to me. Your mother's clever chemistry and cool, dry storage, it all adds up. There. She flicked on the projector's light bulb, which threw a flood of soft light onto the droopy old screen. Alma said, I'm so glad Pavla has her grandmother's bent for science and technology. I've neglected them, and I wonder, at this late date, if that's been my biggest failing. Her voice trailed off as she rattled the drapes shut, sealing out the day completely, in terms of measurable outcomes. What? Because you've devoted your life to artistic explorations rather than scientific? Exploring is exploring, whatever the realm. Applied sciences save lives, dear, and old films and king's ransoms. But applied arts will save humanity, mark my words. Alma laughed. May, you're the best tonic ever. Thank you. May wound the film feed manually until the screen showed a fuzzy bullseye. She adjusted the focus to relative sharpness. She flicked a switch and sprockets whirred. Symphonic music surged into the air, ushering in a color and sound wonder of filming that used Maya's ingenious improvements to the Technicolor process, bringing costs down considerably. With the title Maha Prajapati, a bright sitar solo rose over the recording of a symphonic orchestra with a subtle tabla backbeat that ebbed and flowed throughout the film. This section is written in film script format, which is different than regular text in a novel. It has descriptive paragraphs, and then it names each character and their lines that follow. But I think that you'll be able to follow this well enough if I read it more or less as written. Maha Prajapati wears a sari and sits crying under an ancient tree in a garden. She's played by Sunokwa, Maya Solari's mother, then a radiant young woman identical to Maya, Alma, and Pavla at age 20. Mahamaya appears, largely pregnant, beside the weeping girl and draws her into an embrace, which fails to comfort. She's played by Sunokwa's mother, identical to her daughter and granddaughter when nearing middle age. Mahaprajapati, must it be this way, mother? Mahamaya, nodding her head. We have the baby boy, without trace or trouble. Mahaprajapati, but we can get another newborn orphan another time. Do you have to die in childbirth now? Mahamaya, you're crying as if I really will, as if I'm really pregnant. Yes, I must go. Lao Tse and Confucius need me. Better to raise the boy thinking his mother dead than knowing she abandoned him. My work ends here, and yours begins. Mahaprajapati, whispering, I'll be so alone, so lonely. Mahamaya, you'll have little Siddhartha to love, and you'll fill my role as queen. You'll be busy and fulfilled, believe me. And you know, of course, that it takes great traumas, such loss and gain of great love, to engender the next of us. This perhaps will be your necessary great stirring. Mahaprajapati, it's so unfair. You begot me through a tumble, literally, into the greatest of love. Must I be abandoned and my heart break to trigger the miracle? Mahamaya, with her forefinger to Prajapati's lips, never compare. You will fall in love with your little brother Siddhartha more than you can guess. How fate determines your motherhood is beyond your control, but within your acceptance. You must live and love with that. We are one, but not the same. The important thing is that we continue and that our work reaches understanding ears and requisite actions. Cut to King Suddhodana, a gray-haired monarch standing in the garden. He wears loose silk robes and carries a newborn baby in his arms. He cries over the flower-laden bier of Mahamaya, no longer pregnant, lying in suspended animation, expertly feigning death. Suddhodana, to the baby. She was too old to bear you, too delicate to survive. My prayers for a son are answered at the price of my queen. What a bittersweet blessing. Suddhodana gently touches Mahamaya's cheek. Suddhodana, continuing speaking to his inanimate wife, where have the years gone? 20 years lie in your face, yet to my eyes you are as young and beautiful as the day we met. Fade to an elephant carrying Mahamaya as a teenage girl, played by Sunokwa. King Suddhodana, years her senior, and a small royal entourage crowd near its feet. Suddhodana, voiceover. Listen, my son, my pride, my heir. She appeared before me on an elephant, a vision of perfection. I halted the elephant to better see its lovely burden, which startled the beast and it tossed her at my feet. Cut to the young Mahamaya lies crumpled on the ground. Suddhodana, voiceover, she nearly died. I saved her and wed her with my eyes the minute hers opened to mine. She felt exactly as I did, fated to marry me. We had a child, alas, a girl, as quickly as a child can come. Then, for nearly 20 years of sweetest love and devotion, nothing, no more children, neither girl nor boy. Cut to the king standing next to his wife's bier, speaking to the infant son in his arms. Suddhodana continuing, I had to have an heir, so bless her at this late date. She and the gods grace me with you, the boy of my dreams. Siddhartha, every wish fulfilled. Except that I overlooked wishing that your mother lived, too. And look, there she lies beyond us forever. I am so sorry, turns to hide his tears, so devastated. Cut to, in the palace nursery, Mahaprajapati holds baby Siddhartha and hums to him. Mahaprajapati, mother was right, I adore you, you fill my heart with love. I'll raise you to be the wisest, best prince ever, the Buddha of all Buddhas, the wisest of men. Have come and proclaimed this. I'll make sure it comes true. King Suddhodana enters the room and happily scoops the child from her arms. Suddhodana, lucky Siddhartha, you have Prajapati, the best of sisters, and mother, too, masses Prajapati's hair, and I have a daughter for my queen. Mahaprajapati, hesitantly, father, this is difficult to tell you. I have news. Remember how mother's trauma of falling from the elephant and the joy of meeting you led quickly to your marriage, my conception, and birth? The king smiles with the memory. Mahaprajapati, continuing,
For me, the trauma of losing mother and the joy of loving Siddhartha has gotten me with child, I'm sure. Shuddhodana. What? With whom? The gossips will say it was I who, oh, evil thought. Mahaprajapati. They treat me already as if I were mother reincarnate, your younger wife returned. They're so forgetful and confused, saying that Siddhartha was also conceived from a fall from the elephant to make a miracle of his birth, as if 20 years hadn't passed. They can make a miracle of my pregnancy too, except I'll have a girl, I promise, and we must guard against them making a scandal of it. Shuddhodana. So who have you been with? Do you wish to marry him? Mahaprajapati, shaking her head. No one. And no, I am Siddhartha's mother's first, not another's wife. I do not wish ever to marry. I will raise Siddhartha to be a great man, good and wise. Shuddhodana. And no begging Buddha, not my son. He'll be a prince and warrior. Mahaprajapati. He'll make you proud, father. Your name will be remembered among the stars. Shuddhodana. If this pregnancy doesn't bring us shame. Mahaprajapati. Smiling, shaking her head. Please, don't question this miracle of my daughter-to-be. And don't worry, I'll keep so busy with Siddhartha that no one, save the trusted few helping with him, will see my growing girth. This little sister for him is also written in the stars. A girl like mother and like me. Have we ever shamed you in any way? Shuddhodana. No, never. Mahaprajapati. Then trust me, us. We will never fail you. Shuddhodana. Lovingly. You are so like your mother. A mystery I can see and touch, but never fathom. Wonders within wonders, you women. Siddhartha will have a little sister, and that will be a blessing. Mahaprajapati, smiling warmly, studies the king for a long moment. Mahaprajapati, thank you, father. You are a great king, in every way, including your careful attentions to what mother said and wished for. And now I ask of you. She takes Siddhartha back to her arms. Mahaprajapati to Siddhartha. Remember that. Our father is the king who keeps us safe and well, so we might live to fulfill what is written in our shared destiny. Alma leapt to the projector to stop the film before the end of it flip-flapped free. May rewound it while Alma opened the drapes. Dust poofed and danced in the day's light. Alma said, I needed to see mother and grandmother so young, as Pavla and I follow in their footsteps. The longer view, the larger context settles my heart somehow. May nodded, her eyes brimming with tears. Oh, May, this has upset you. I'm so sorry. May smiled. In the best way. David played Shuddhodana, and that's his music. Composed, conducted, and played on sitar. She sighed. Such genius. We met making that film. It could have been yesterday. He was a friend of your grandmother's, nearly twice my age. Now I'm over twice his when he died. We had only 10 years together, but this silly old heart is still 17, still in love at first sight, first song. Alma said, such little time you had together, yet how lucky you remain, enchanted forever. What a gift he gave you. Those were happy days for all of us, making the films and soundtracks, exhausting too. We had loads of equipment, when space and equipment were available, and worked night after night until dawn. But it was so fulfilling, so necessary and worthwhile. I was wardrobe mistress, makeup artist, prop assistant, and general gopher. It's all in my basement still, except the elephant. Alma laughed. We should remake these films, shouldn't we? Pavla has a sabbatical year coming up. After stopping here, I'm going to mind Luna while her mother winds up her research. Then we'll have time for a little retelling. We can advance the stories to when the youngest daughters were Luna's age. What an exciting prospect, building on mother's work while finding our balance again without her. May said, I'll help you any way I can, and your room here is always clean and ready. I may take you up on that. Mother always felt especially safe here, and your research makes this a treasured haven. I hope Pavla knows she's welcome too, with Luna. I'm sure she does, but it's not quite suitable for a baby at present, May laughed. It's impossible for a baby now, but I'll get Nikos to help me tidy up when he returns. He'll be delighted. He's been nagging me gently, of course, for years. Alma replied, if you wish, but realistically, I suspect your work is far too important to disturb. I'm sure you know where every paper is, and if you spend time moving it around, you'll lose valuable working time. Yes, but life takes precedence over papers. All these notes about your past mean nothing if your future isn't secure. True, but please, don't do this for me, for us. I'm happy surrounded by your industry, inspired by it. The only question, and this is difficult, is what will become of your house and this great legacy after you're gone. I'm sure you've got it all arranged. A young cousin is my sole heir. That's him. She pointed to the photo of Larry on the piano top. Larry Singer, director of television news at Media 8. And your Singer Jones. I never put them together, but of course, Mother knew. She finally met him the day before she flew to Jeddah. She'd asked a CMO about 5-6 years ago when he took the director's chair, but he hadn't been ready until recently. He's a dear boy, but very driven, unmindful of details and peripherals that don't serve him directly. He's starting to pay more attention now that, I'm sorry to say, he's hit a bit of a rough patch. Overwork, midlife considerations, some illness or condition he's keeping to himself. Your mother caught it right away the minute she saw him, though she had no time to discuss the particulars. You'll see it too, I'm sure, when you meet him. Alma smiled. How did they get on? She thought he might want to see her again. The truth is, she bowled him over. I bet. Mother's magic. I'll do my best to, at least, bowl him under. I'll arrange it when you're next in town, if you'd like. His partner is in theater. You might want to meet him, too. Director, actor. He's at the old Hippodrome, you know. The Frank Merrick Performing Arts Center, all fixed up, bigger and beautiful again. Lovely. We might be of some use to each other, particularly if he's caught rumors of my theater work. I've got something in mind that requires a venue. I'll have them both lined up for you, whenever it suits you. Your room is always ready, that's a given. In perpetuity, I hope, when Larry's clued into the importance of this place as a refuge for you and your family. Well, we have it now, and for that we're grateful. What of your papers, dare I ask? If I drop dead tomorrow, and I have no such plans, I assure you, my grandfather lived to be 104, and I expect to best him, Larry will follow the instructions of my will and send them to Sinclair's, then, well, you know the route. Alma nodded with a smile, back to Henry. She sipped the last of her cold tea and said, Now, a few key details, then alas, I must fly. Mother died at exactly 1:07 a.m., local time, February 12th. Yes, Nikos told me. It was spectacular, so much shattered rock, so many coincidentals, I'm sure. She pointed to May's newspaper with the small rectangle cut out. Is that what you've been clipping? Yes, and I'm going to get Larry checking global sources for me. He won't know why, but it will come together quickly for him as the evidence mounts and I fill him in. Good. Thank you, dear May, for everything. I knew I had to see you. I knew you'd bolster me, and you've done it beyond my best hopes. At the door, Alma wrapped her arms warmly around tiny May, who absorbed the hug as if it were spring sunshine. Alma then donned her wig and dark glasses, and the big-haired blonde vanished.